Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to the Baking, Boiling, Subterranean Culture Bunker, your weekly pop culture hideout. I'm Andrew Harrison.
And I'm Alex Andreu. On this week's edition, Enter Sandman. The Netflix adaptation of Neil Gaiman's acclaimed comic series, The Sandman, is exciting even people who would never touch a comic book with a set of tongs. What will we make of it?
Plus, the producer that everybody wants, Danger Mouse, returns to his hip-hop roots with the new album Cheat Codes in collaboration with the MC Black Thought from The Roots. And we turn our baseball hats backwards and shout Radical Dude as we enter the pure living hell of Woodstock 99 as laid bare in the Netflix documentary Trainwreck. Is there something darker going on with this film than simple schadenfreude?
Plus, we've got new tunes for your ears and, of course, more selections of the greatest record ever made. All this and more on today's Culture Bunker.
Welcome to the podcast. It's summertime, and like many a business, we just can't get the staff these days. So we have just one special guest for you today. Returning to the podcast, it's renowned music business writer, a man who a very miffed Jack White once called a tabloid journalist. It's Eamon Ford. Welcome back, Eamon.
Hello. You can't get the staff and you can't get the guests. Hence me being here.
It's high quality, I think. It's raising the average quality of the guests.
No. It's about quantity rather than quality. I'm just filling a seat. Like you get at those big posh award shows, they have the seat fillers when celebrities go to the bathroom for extended periods of time and then come back jovially. There's people who are paid to sit in their seats.
They've just been talking to their agent is what it is usually. So you've broke the rule of a lifetime this summer and went to an actual festival in the outdoors. You went to the Secret Garden Party. How was that, Eamon, for a man who loves festivals?
I went with my girlfriend Sonia, who insisted that we go because I was doing a talk on the Sunday for my book, and they offered us glamping for the entire weekend. And Sonia said we should go for the entire weekend, and then by Saturday morning she said I have made a terrible mistake. And she was not talking about me, she was talking about being at the festival. But there was extreme and very public hedonism that was happening in the crowd in daylight hours, and then probably even worse happening in the nighttime hours. But people seem very vivified, let's say, in bursts of, I don't know, 30 minutes.
I don't even know what to say. So what would it take to make a music festival Ford friendly?
Hotels. And no bands, yes. If it can finish at 10 o'clock, that would be good. If I can be on site and see everything I need to see in a four-hour period and then can leave and go to a hotel where I can actually have a proper night's sleep and a bathroom and eat breakfast that doesn't cost £4,000 for a raggedy bit of bacon in a steel roll, I would be happy.
And if the headliner was, say, Avatars of Blanche from Coronation Street?
I would be there. I would stage dive.
You are so my tribe. It's incredible.
With your music business analyst hat on, are you terribly excited about the first ever TikTok classical album that's coming out? Orchestral versions of the biggest TikTok sounds, whatever that means.
It's out yesterday, if this is going out on Saturday. It came out, I got a press release and had to check that it really was from Warner Music that this thing had been created. And I listened to it, and it's exactly what you think. And it's
But is it tunes or is it like an orchestration of the sound of somebody slamming the door?
I think they have, one of the tracks I listened to was Levitating by Dua Lipa, and I think they used her vocals from the track, I think, or someone who sounds incredibly like her. So I guess they've sampled stuff. It's very weird, but it almost feels like it's a kind of SEO thing on Spotify where someone just types in TikTok music and that'll kind of hit high up on the list. And it reminds me of, I think it was Sony did this at Christmas. They did a greatest Christmas playlist ever, or Christmas music playlist or something like that, so that when people were asking for Christmas music on Alexa or other voice assistants, that it would play their playlist. So it feels like an attempt to game the algorithm a little bit.
I think if I was a crap band, I'd change my name to Christmas Music.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you're just laughing, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we get started, don't forget you can get the Culture Bunker and all our shows early and without adverts when you support the Bunker on Patreon. That's daily episodes on politics, science, pop culture, and much more. Delightfully ad-free. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more. And if you want to help us out a little more, why not fill in our listener survey? The link is in the show notes, and you could win one of 5 Bunker t-shirts. Why not do it right now while you're listening to the show? Mr. Sandman, dream me a dream, make it the darkest, most twisted I've ever seen. When a human magician traps Dream, the eternal being in charge of the dream realm, for 100 years, his kingdom suffers, ordinary people suffer, nightmares escape, and his magical equipment is stolen. Once free, Dream, played by Tom Sturridge, must regather his equipment and restore order. But what if order doesn't particularly care for being restored? Sandman on Netflix is based on the Neil Gaiman comic book series. Here's a trailer.
Your waking world is shaped by dreams. Dreams and nightmares that I create and which I must control.
He's out there looking for me, isn't he?
Can you imagine the damage he could do?
I need your help. If dreams disappear, then so will humanity.
I could do without dreams for a while. I haven't had a decent night's sleep in ages.
I'm not going to stop until I've reshaped this world.
Tell us, what power have dreams given her?
Eamon, as often with a fantasy genre, to enjoy it, you have to either willingly give yourself over to it, or it has to overcome your cynicism and drag you in. Did Sandman do either for you?
I watched 2 episodes and bailed because it's not for me, but I am very intrigued to see what you 2 comic geeks make of this.
And actually, I'm not a comic geek.
I thought you were.
No.
Okay. Fantasy geek.
I love the visuals.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I want you to explain it to me, because there is a presumption with something like this that if you come in cold, there's so much history, there's so many deep references when you take a comic book and transfer it into a TV series or a film or whatever. So it presumes a lot of prior knowledge, and I guess it rewards you if you have that prior knowledge. But I think if you're coming in cold, it leaves you cold, or it certainly left me cold. It was not something that I felt I wanted to kind of investigate further, but that's happily me putting my hands up and going, I probably didn't understand any of the nuance, any of the depths, any of the reference points. But I just felt like it felt a little exclusionary for people who weren't already pre-invested in the show. But I'm very happy to have it comic book explained to me.
Well, actually, weirdly, I am a comic book geek, as listeners will know, but I actually never read Sandman. I've never read any of the comics at all. Okay. I quite like Neil Gaiman stuff, but it's a bit like being a rock journalist and going, like, no, I just never got around to listening to the Rolling Stones. Just never listened to them. you know, because it's such a big thing. It's a massive, massive
thing.
Have
you read any of it now?
Odds and sods, but I thought I will do the experiment of going in cold. I'll try and be Dan, I did spot one or two things that I recognise from DC Comics, like the rhyming demon and the appearance of Cain and Abel in the House of Mystery and the House of Secrets. They're all drawn from DC Comics. But the rest of it, I didn't know any of it, and I was carried along perfectly well.
I think, though, you are from that world. It appeals to, it hits all your pleasure nodes. Even if you don't necessarily know the nuances of the story, you understand where it fits into the wider context of comic books and their transition onto the screen and so forth, which wasn't my insight into it. It was just I lacked those reference points, I think.
So the concept was completely new to me, but the grammar and the pacing and the world is very, very familiar to me.
For me, it takes a bunch of familiar myths, essentially, and puts them in a bag and shakes them. And I fully understand that some people might find the result derivative because of that, but I find it quite original because of that, because it takes, you know, concepts that I know about angels, about, you know, Cain and Abel, about Lucifer, about, and slightly twists it into something else. So I quite like finding out in this slightly different version of the biblical reality, effectively, how things are different. A show like this lives or dies, I think, by its central performance. How does Tom Sturridge do we think? How about you?
Well, in the first, the opening episode, is he barely speaks because he's kind of captured in a way, without giving any spoilers away. So a lot of it is just kind of slow movement and kind of eye contact and things like that. And he kind of looked like a really malnourished Bernard from Black Books, I thought. And I was hoping maybe he would have that kind of excessive alcohol and cigarette intake to kind of fuel his misanthropic approach. And I know that some people online have kind of made the Zoolander reference and things like that, because there's a lot of blue steel acting going on before he actually gets to speak. He speaks a bit more in the second episode, so you can kind of... And he does look... He's certainly got an incredibly striking look. And, like, he's got one of those faces that that kind of will draw you in, and I guess... I can kind of understand why particularly young people would kind of see him as some kind of icon, and they would really buy into...
He's goth eye candy.
Absolutely.
I couldn't get out of the... It took me a long while to stop thinking...
Were you fanning yourself?
It's like... No, it took me a long time to stop thinking it's like Robert Smith, but really thin and pouty.
Yes. Actually, that is kind of... A huge appeal of the Sandman comic was it brought a load of people whose main kind of framework of the world was, you know, goth music, goth iconography, brought them into comics, which was great, I thought.
I had an issue with the CGI, but then I was thinking about it, and maybe the CGI was dialed up to like 25, and it was so hyper-real that it started to look cheap and kind of jarring, but I don't know, was that intentional, because it is this whole bleeding between the world of dreams and real world and fantasy and so forth. But it felt, it was so heavy on the CGI at points, you could just say, right, okay, they're standing in front of a green screen and there's nothing else there. And I find that quite distracting. But then I was wondering, was that intentional, or is that just part of the CGI arms race where you just have to just layer it on and on and on and on? And it's
probably a mix of both, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, it's out there trying to compete with a new Lord of the Rings on Amazon Prime and the new addition to the Game of Thrones franchise. And I guess they're trying to make the production values big for bigness's sake in some ways.
But it's worth pointing out, actually, that this is really, it's an anthology series, and I'm six in, and many of the episodes contrast enormously. There is a literal journey into hell where we meet Gwendolyn Christie of Game of Thrones fame, Brienne of Tarth, you know, the seven-foot tall big son.
Gwendolyn Christie.
She's playing Lucifer with the big black wings. This is on a grand, epic scale, a reproduction of hell that absolutely sears the eyes. Loads and loads going on. The following episode is almost like it's a David Mamet bottle episode in a diner, which is in many ways more horrific than the journey into hell. I really like that, because as well as having the part of the comic's grammar that is preserved is that one issue might be very different to the one you've just read.
Because there were different artists, apparently, because Gaiman collaborated with different visual artists.
Oh, right.
The visual style from book to book, from story to story, can be very, very different.
So they've actually made that effort in the thing. So is it...
To make things look...
Does it evolve in the same way that something like WandaVision did, which was... They were obviously playing with genre motifs, but then stylistically, each episode was very different. So is it a bit like that?
Well, WandaVision foregrounded that and actually made it part of the story. Yeah. This is backgrounded. What it does is what great comics often do, which is you have a long arc of, and in this case, it's Dream, a.k.a. Morpheus, attempting to return, get his various symbols of office back to return his power. But within it, there are just moments. There are just what in games you would call side quests. There's a fantastic episode with a character called Hobgadling, who Dream and his sister meet in 1489. And he's in the pub, and Hobgadling is in this ancient tavern saying, I don't want to die, I want to live forever. But people think it would be awful, I think it would be great. And his wish is granted. And they go back and Dream goes back and meets him every 100 years. Now, that's essentially a Twilight Zone episode. And I loved it. It's self-contained, great little performances, tremendous fun, has, as all great comics do, it feeds into the wider story in small ways. But you can watch it entirely on its own and get a lot from it. Beautifully acted, and it goes very much against the usual portrayal of immortality in comics and science fiction, which is, oh, it'd be terrible, it'd be awful, it'd be begging for death. Not Hobgadling.
Yeah, I don't entirely agree about the acting. I thought the acting was patchy, actually. Yeah. I thought it was a series...
Well, you're a professional.
Right. Well, I thought it was a series weak link. I mean, Sturridge does do a little bit too much pouting and tilting and staring at the camera. Thewlis, even. David Thewlis.
Yes.
I found that for some episodes, he was sort of playing an atmosphere rather than a character. Yeah. It's only in the diner episode that he really begins to flesh.
Where he's almost silent and immobile,
Where he's really beginning to flesh out the character. There are people like Viviana Chemapong as Lucienne, who I think is splendid. Yeah. And Patton Oswalt, choosing Patton Oswalt as the voice of a raven, I think... is an absolute stroke of genius. He's the little guy from United States of Tara and Parks and Recreation and all. And he's got like a really... He sounds like a New York stand-up comic.
Yes.
And it's just really, really...
He's a good sidekick.
A great choice and a funny thing. I thought the art direction is spectacular. Mm. I really enjoyed... the sort of different places to which it goes. Hell is especially stunning. They do weird things with the aspect ratio, which apparently loads of people have been calling up Netflix and going, is there something, is my telly selecting the wrong thing?
Why is this film about living in a world of dreams look a bit weird on my on my telly? I don't understand it. Why is it a bit surreal and unusual?
No,
is that their objection?
Well, not exactly. No, they, as an artistic choice, apparently, in the dream realm, they stretch the it's a letterbox format, and they stretch the top third to just make it look like everything is about to evaporate, I guess, or kind of going into the distance. So it's not just people being totally stupid, but I think it's a really interesting, unusual choice that I haven't seen before of someone messing with a visual format in that way. I think the soundtrack is terrific because I'm picking up a lot of Baroque instruments in there and with it electronic and loads of sampling, and it all just sounds like it's timeless but also really futuristic and weird.
I'm also getting the classic theme tune thing of I hear that line and immediately my brain is going, he is the Sandman, he is the Sandman, your line of duty. That's often something. I don't know whether they intend to do this, but maybe this is what happens when you're trying to write the theme tune.
They definitely go for leitmotifs. They definitely repeat little riffs. The array of star guests.
It's incredible.
Is incredible. I mean, it's almost disrespectful to sort of get Charles Dance and just get him to do 10 minutes in the first episode, or, you know, Stephen Fry, Jolie Richards, and Mark Hamill. Mark Hamill plays a man with a pumpkin for a head. You never even see him.
Well, he's a trooper.
Gwendolyn Christie, like you said, Roger Allam, dozens of British comedians, Lenny Henry, Nina Wadia, Andy Osho, many, many more. I love the way the narrative is linear because I'm so tired of trying to work out where in time we are precisely. So broadly speaking, the timeline is linear, but it does stretch bits that are to do with character development and kind of go quickly over bits that are expositional. And I quite like that pacing. So all in all, I mean, I've seen five episodes. It's really drawn me in and I'm not...
You know, my main kind of... The reason I didn't read the comic was I thought, this is a bit goth for me. That was what turned me off. But I've been absolutely won over by this, really enjoying
it. Can I ask you something on that? So with all these things from MCU films to The Walking Dead to Sandman, now that you've experienced kind of both, you've seen loads of stuff where you knew the comics really well and now something where you didn't, do you think people who know the comics get more or less out of them? Is it, can you become immersed if you know the comic really well, or does it become a game of spot the difference?
There are a couple of ways to react if you know the comics. One is to get really nitpicky and start complaining that somehow it's been got, in quotes, wrong. Now, there is no getting it wrong. Just because somebody who was up against a scripting deadline in 1989 made a particular decision about a character does not mean that that is kind of canon or right or correct. Writers must serve the story. And if you need to change it, then change it. That shows more respect to the idea than slavishly reproducing Fantastic Four issue 12, much as I'd like to see Fantastic Four issue 12 on the big screen. When it's, I find, speaking from my community of nerds, I find that when it's aimed squarely at us, it's a bit disappointing. It's, if it's just there to be faithful and kind of slavishly accurate, it tends not to work. Whereas when people, much as, say, Russell Davis did when he remade Doctor Who, you know, he clearly loves it. Enough to mess around with it, enough to change things, enough to go against the established stuff. I love the fact that I could, you know, spot the bit in Hell where the demon Etrigan should have been. But that's just a little thing for me. That bringing in the actual character from the comic would not have added at all to the general viewer's enjoyment of it. And therefore, don't do it. Do what's necessary for the big audience, I think.
Eamon, have we piqued your interest enough to get you to push through with another couple of episodes?
In a word, no. Life is too short. I give it a go, and you have to understand your limits in culture. It's like if I had flat out refused to watch it and said I hate it, then that would have been a bad thing. I give it a go, and it's not for me. And as you get older, you go, that's absolutely fine. I'm
cool.
Happy.
Yeah.
I'm happy that people are delighted by this. I didn't hate it, but I just didn't understand the layers. So it felt really alien to me.
Perfectly respectable, I think.
Yeah.
I've become quite shrewd about stopping films after 20 minutes now if they don't.
But
I
think an adaptation of Sandman that didn't provoke that reaction amongst the kind of people for whom this is just, it's not your thing, you'll be doing it wrong.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. It's something that's clearly layered and has a lot of depth and draws in reference points from lots of different places, and to do it straight, to do the normie version for someone like me, it's just got to kill everything that made it interesting. But I almost feel like you want to get, like, remember those books you used to get when you were studying Shakespeare for GCSE, the cheap books.
The Sandman for Dummies.
Yeah. Something like that. Or basically at the end, there's a little 15-minute synopsis on the red button which goes, okay.
There we go.
Right, we're going to boil this down to stupid Eamon level and I will explain everything.
There we
and
go.
Then it's your choice to play the next one. So, yeah, if you want to broaden your audience, I think put in that handrail for people like me.
We always ask our guests to bring in a tune that they're currently obsessed with as a service to you, the listener, and then we put them on our Spotify and Tidal playlists with links in the show notes. Eamon, what have you chosen to bring in?
I brought in a song called Undo the Blue by Irina Mancini, or Mancini. Mm-hmm. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And it might be the forerunner as my single of the year already.
Right.
I love it. And it's like, you listen to it and it's basically a kind of update of Les Fleurs by Minnie Riperton. And she doesn't go and hit Minnie Riperton notes. But it's like, it's a wonderful confection. She did a couple of really great singles last year. There was Deep End, which was just, it sounded like a lost Northern Soul track. And then Do It, You Stole the Rhythm. And we really like her.
So what do we know about her?
She is a DJ, so I think she does. I think she's got a show on Soho Radio, and I think she kind of DJs at kind of lots of fashionable parties and has been making music for a few years. I think maybe was she in other bands beforehand? I'm not sure. But it's just a wonderful, wonderful song, and it's 9 thumbs up for me.
Okie doke. Well, it's going on the playlist, of course, and here is a clip. This is Irina Mancini with Undo the Blue. You may well know the multiple Grammy-winning hip-hop producer Danger Mouse from Gnarls Barkley of Does That Make Me Crazy fame, or maybe Demon Days by Damon Albarn's Gorillaz, or perhaps Beck's Modern Guilt album. If you're a real hip-hop head, you'll definitely know his Danger Doom work with MF Doom, the album The Mouse and the Mask. Danger Mouse's superpower is to make the dense bump and grind of sample-based hip-hop into, somehow, accessible pop music. But he hasn't made a proper hip-hop record in some 17 years, until now. Cheat Codes is out this weekend, and it's a collaboration with the rapper Black Thought of hip-hop band The Roots. Now, it's fair to say that neither Alex, Eamon nor I are exactly head-nodding gangster b-boys from the deadly street corners of Mykonos, Ballymena or Magull, but we're going to see what we think after you listen to this track. This is Aquamarine, featuring podcast favourite Michael Kiwanuka.
Hustling Nick's a reefer to tussling with the reaper. Sensory deprivation to ultimate synesthesia. Freeing our brother's keeper from teeth of another creature. Breaking and entering to the theater. The search and seizure is the birth of genius. Somewhere between Earth and Venus. At her convenience, even non-believers make prayers. Haters and naysayers is buried in cake layers.
Hey, man, I'm one of those people who says, yeah, yeah, I really like hip-hop, and then I realize I haven't listened to anything new since A Tribe Called Quest. Is this because hip-hop no longer has to try to be accessible to Joe Schmo like me, because it's now so vast?
I think so. I think so. You'll get crossover acts. You'll get a Kendrick Lamar that kind of unites everyone. Maybe hip-hop heads kind of go, oh, he's too commercial, or he's too crossover, or whatever. But I absolutely love this album. I think it's incredible. It's definitely, I've only been playing it for like 3 or 4 days, and it's already front-runner. Top 5 albums a year so far. It's just brilliant, because sonically he's got a clear vision of where he wants this to go, and there's lots of brilliant reference. Obviously he's drawn in on samples. He's got a massive turn of really good guest vocalists as well, and there's lots of reference points, 60s soul, 70s into Stax and stuff like that, and massive tunes as well. He's obviously, the production is incredible. And kind of how he uses and weaves in the samples and uses the vocals is incredible. But he's done Pop 101, which is just right bangers.
Yeah. Really. Well, this is what I loved about it. It's like, when I run into contemporary hip-hop now, my major kind of old man objection is, there's not much going on here, is it? It's just the rhymes and a beat and not much else. Encounter like Run the Jewels, and there's loads going on. It's very exciting. This, to me, felt like it was connected directly to the likes of Eric B. and Rakim, or Stetsasonic, the kind of old guy stuff that I like, when it was fully realised sound world rather than just beats as a vehicle kind of thing.
Yeah, and well, there are beats there, but it's not reduced down to this kind of minimalist stripped back thing. It's like he's just piling stuff on there, but it's not overwhelming. There's a lot happening, and the more you listen to it, the kind of the deeper into this kind of sonic world you sink. Yeah. And yeah, I just think it's just brilliant, and it actually does, cliche alert, it does flow like an album.
It certainly flows like an album,
because I can't think of a duff track on there. I think everything kind of works. So there's kind of, there's peaks and troughs, and there's a journey, man, and all of that. But yeah, it's just like, as a piece of songwriting, it's incredible. And as a piece of production, it's super incredible.
It's also incredibly dense and it's, you know, packed with meaning the way you want hip hop to be. Every line is there to be unpacked. There's, you know, Black Thought on the track Belize, he's writing, my bars are as hard as Angola's bars, as in bars of rhymes at Angola prison in Louisiana, the kind of infamous one. Do you think that, like, people actually listen to hip-hop full-time, I'm going to go, yeah, that's what it's always like. What are you so excited about?
Yeah, well, but maybe if this becomes the album that then is your trigger point to go back and go, well, you should also be listening to X, Y, and Z, I think is really important. I mean, and I guess you need those kind of crossover albums or those albums that kind of appeal to a broader audience so that, okay, this can be your way either into this world or your way back into this world if you're kind of terribly old, and I guess. Although there is one thing, and I'm intrigued to see how this plays out in the next couple of weeks in the light of what happened with the Lizzo album and the Beyoncé album, because it's the MF Doom track or MFI Doom track. And there is a...
The S word.
Yes, there's a very, very kind of... it kind of sucks the air out of the room when there's a very clear ableist slur. Yeah. And it's pretty much the same issue that was with the Lizzo album and the Beyoncé album. So I'm wondering if that's going to be scrubbed from it, because I think the pressure... And the kind of the moral, ethical arguments around artists like this kind of taking a step back and going, right, we shouldn't have said that.
Americans don't take that word as seriously as we do here for some reason, yes.
Yeah, but I think just it coming, and obviously this has been recorded before all of that controversy, that doesn't obviously excuse the use of the word, and it was recorded, well, he died in, what, 2020? So it was recorded before he died. But even then, it's still one of those words that kind of sucks the out of the room as soon as you hear it. And I think that was and you don't want to be kind of thought police or anything like that, but I think that's the one where you just go, ooh,
a bit of a needle scratch, isn't it?
Yeah.
Alex, as a man with enough opera records in his house to build another house from, how are you on hip-hop?
I'm ecumenical in my music tastes, to be honest. I listen to all sorts, with the exception of death metal, just because I don't like people screaming at me, and Christian rock, because I don't like people screaming at me. I will listen to everything. I was astounded by this, absolutely blown over. In my view, usually, musical collaborations don't work.
Sports. Collaborations don't work. They've written a song for collaboration that goes, collaborations don't work, they don't work. Anyway.
but you know, there are famous ones that work, and behind them is, a litter yard of terrible ones that don't. Because either the clash is too much and the result is unmusical, or there's so much compromise that it just becomes brown. And, you know, both lose their identity. And I think this is one of the best working musical collaborations that I've ever heard. I mean, on one side, you have a sort of soul jazz cinematic soundscape. And on the other, you have this rap track that acts as a narration. And the overwhelming feeling I had, especially when I was listening to it the second time on my headphones, was of this really cool dude walking down the street in a black exploitation film and hearing the internal monologue. That's the thing I had in my head. I thought it was just utterly terrific. I will disagree on all rap necessarily being great. I think we have enough examples of it not being so great.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I just want to read you one lyric that I noted down. The morning star Tariq, I was born to be a teacher. Whether scorpion or the frog, the nature of the creature is to evolve. Though it's the savage beast we truly are, my words should be studied up in Berkeley and Juilliard.
You know, the one that I noted down, actually, I noted down the next lines from that bit, which go, my words should be studied up in Berkeley and Juilliard. All my bars are hard as solid gold bullion. My name in the Quran like the kingdom of Suleiman. You done lost your mind trying to call me a Moulinian. And I don't know what a Moulinian was, but it's an Italian-American racist slur against black. But it's like, this is improve your word power and your understanding of black America
but also,
to the max.
Just straight up as poetry.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it really should be studied.
Is this basically going to be thousands of words when you go on the entry in Genius?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like it's like dense texts explaining every reference.
It really feels like you're watching two people at the very top of the game.
Yeah.
It feels virtuosic, doesn't
yeah.
it? It feels like one of those insane clips of a violinist that's playing something that seems inhumanly fast or something yeah. like that. That's how it...
Wasn't it a really long-running collaboration? They were supposed to do something yeah. 15 years ago, and then Danger Mouse's career took over, and then they kind of came back. So it's been yeah. this thing that they've been thinking about and working on for a decade and a half.
Danger Mouse being so work-shy and absolutely just can't get him to do anything. Got another album coming out next month with Broken Bells, the thing.
Oh, yeah.
He's made records with Mark Linkous from Sparkle Horse. Yeah. He produced a Norah Jones album. It's fantastic that you can come across something from a genre that you, in some respects you kind of think has kind of reached its apogee of development, and then something comes along like this.
I think it's got this potential to be a proper crossover album that will there's lots of people who will go, oh, and I've been arguing this for 30-odd years, hip-hop's not real music. Which is just ridiculous. And you can go, right, okay, here is an entry album for you
yeah.
in the same way that, I don't know, 3 Feet High and Rising was or yeah. something like that. This is an album that everyone can find some way into. You can be a hardcore hip-hop fan, or you can be somebody who vaguely follows it or used to follow it or has no understanding of it. And there's enough reference points, there's enough amazing tunes in yep. there to draw you in.
Well, he's got the middle-aged white guy.
He's got that demographic.
He's absolutely laughing. Well done, Danger Mouse. Well done, yeah. Black Thought.
Yes. Let's have a coffee around our coffee table.
Yes. Finally, we're making an educated guess that many listeners may have put themselves through the experience of Netflix's documentary Trainwreck, Woodstock 99, a three-part exploration of the planning, staging, and ultimate collapse into violent anarchy of a 1999 revival of the original hippie festival. That original Woodstock featured Santana, Janis Joplin, Joe Cocker, and Jimi Hendrix. It became an endlessly deified article of faith for the US counterculture. The 1999 revival, after a similarly messy one in 1994, was anything but. And with a very non-peace and love lineup, including Limp Bizkit, Korn, and Kid Rock, breadhead promoters at the controls, a setting on a disused Air Force base, and a brodacious atmosphere of macho idiocy, which boiled over after 3 sweltering days, it definitely was not 3 days of peace and love. So, what do we make of this documentary, and how do we feel also, especially, about violent sexual assaults being treated as just another part of a crazy rock and roll story? Here's the trailer.
How you guys doing today? Welcome to Woodstock.
There is a sixth sense that you develop when you spend your life going to venues.
Woodstock, baby.
I can tell you 100 feet away what the energy in that venue is going to be like.
It was not your parents' Woodstock.
We got off the bus and I was like, something's not right.
It was like 1,000 degrees.
I think we should leave. It's so hot here. Yeah.
Water was $4 a bottle, which is a ridiculous cost.
The porta potties, unusable. You had kids rolling around in what they thought was mud.
In an environment where exploiting women, you could get away with it.
You could feel something bubbling.
Eamon, this one's clearly coming in the slipstream of the Fyre Festival documentaries that we all watched during lockdown.
Yeah.
It was kind of fun watching spoiled rich kids suffering mild discomfort.
Yeah.
This vibe is not the same, is it?
It's not. And I remember the coverage at the time after it came out and said, oh, this is a bit of a disaster, and kind of they set fire to things. But I had forgotten just how unrelentingly awful the whole experience would be. They're like, every single thing they did was wrong. They put it in the wrong place. They had no infrastructure. They stopped people bringing in food and drinks. They had how they'd worked with the commission stands selling like food and drinks, which basically allowed them to do a very topical phrase at the moment, surge pricing. And as things started to run out, the prices were just being jacked up. So you were having these people in an enormous heat wave being dehydrated, and then basically just drinking alcohol and taking an enormous amount of drugs. You had this awful bro culture. The place was awash with just the absolute worst examples of man in America, in that awful shirt off entitlement that you still get around America. They're probably all selling cryptocurrency at the minute. But just awful, awful people who, you know, don't like music. These were not music people. They basically just wanted to go for a weekend of hedonism and possibly sexual assault if it kind of came their way. They were just horrible, rotten people. And then there were occasionally other people who were interviewed there, and they were kind of quite innocent because they were caught up in this idea about this could be our Woodstock, this could literally be our Woodstock. And the optimism of those people versus the brutality of the people who were ultimately the core demographic. And a huge amount, they talk about the location and all the rest of it, a huge amount of blame has to go on whoever the booker was picking those acts. Because if you're going to have a recreation, 30 years of Woodstock with peace and love, you've got to have the kind of acts who would tap into that, would tap into that sense of community and oneness and so forth. And you're not going to get that with Fred Durst or Kid Rock or Korn. These alpha male, aggressive artists, and they're absolutely fine in their own context. But if you're going to put whatever it was, 200,000 people into a disused airbase and then treat them awfully and then subject them to this kind of music.
And also,
and this
songs kind of, the lyrics are, let's smash shit up. Yeah. I'm going to set fire to something.
Yeah, like ideologically, what, particularly Limp Bizkit, what they represent, it's just horrendous. It's just, there's zero justification for Limp Bizkit. There was an awful bit where their manager, who obviously was coining it in at that time, went, oh, you can't blame Fred Durst for this. Fred Durst was surfing through the crowd on a bit of
the sound tower, the sound tower, they pulled down,
and he was like telling people to smash stuff up. He absolutely was a catalyst for kind of what fell out. But he was also there as the kind of anointed god of those knuckleheaded bros with their shirts off and their t-shirts stuffed down in their pockets.
But that wasn't unknown to the people who booked him.
Yeah,
they absolutely knew. They absolutely knew what they were getting. But also, the lineup was really weird because you had this awful bro sports metal or new metal or whatever you want to call it. And then in the afternoon, you had like Sheryl Crow and Jewel. You had like these completely
getting shit thrown at them.
Yeah. And like there was no, there was no kind of theme to the days. It was basically just, we're going to headline with awful people being awful, and they will encourage the audience to be even more awful. Michael Lang, who was obviously behind the original Woodstock, was involved in this one, heavily involved with this one. And even, like, at the time, you saw the footage of the press conferences, and then he was interviewed. I think they said at the end that he passed away a couple of weeks or a couple of months after he did the interview. And even then, he wasn't getting it, or he was refusing to get that he could be in some way responsible for this awfulness, and that they didn't have a contingency plan for any of this. Yeah.
Alex, what did you think?
So I mean, obviously there were a lot of awful people there, but I also saw a sort of cultural side to it. To me, it seemed like the culmination of the decade of extreme sports, you know. But I mean, by 1999, there was a pay-per-view channel dedicated to very extreme sports. 2000 was the start of Jackass.
Yeah.
And I saw a lot of that. I saw a lot of, let's do the stupidest thing imaginable so we get famous. It just seemed to me that the assumption that a crowd, you know, in the middle of the sort of love power movement, listening to Joan Baez and Jefferson Starship.
Yeah.
Airplane
in those
days. Yeah, Jefferson Airplane in those days. That the reaction of the crowd would be the same as a crowd of effectively hooligans.
Yeah.
Listening to Limp Bizkit and Korn was the one that kind of started it all off. I just think that assumption is just so asinine, yeah. so insane to start with, the idea that you can generate sort of love and togetherness yeah, yeah. by putting with violent yeah. people together with violent music.
And then feeding them drugs and not feeding them food. Sure. Yeah.
There's a producer at one point that says, the quote is, at that point, the train was off the rails and you just didn't know what would happen next. You fucking didn't know what would happen next. You may not have known exactly what would happen next, but you knew it was nothing good.
Well, this brings us to the aspect of the documentary which I found most troubling, which is in the third episode, it's very clear that there's widespread sexual assault, groping and worse going on across the audience. And the documentary is showing you still images of this happening.
Yeah.
And I'm like, not just I don't want to see that. You don't have the right to show that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Documentary. There's that, and it's the fact that at no point is anybody properly held to account, either in the real world or by the filmmaker. It's just like, wow, this was wild. Wasn't it wild? You also see the dimension of the reporters from MTV. It's as well as the apogee of the extreme sports era, it's the apogee of the ironic nothing matters era. You know, people are tearing this place apart. Women are getting assaulted. And the reporters from MTV going, hey, it's going to be crazy and wild out here, isn't it? Yeah. Inverted commas, yeah, eyebrow raised.
Spring break. Woo-hoo!
Spring break, we're here. Yeah,
there was something completely... We are potentially condemning this, but we're also...
But we're too cool to take a stance.
Yeah, but we're also... Have a look at these. Here are topless women. And you can see pictures of kind of men grabbing at them and stuff like that. And it felt like if you're trying to make a moral, ethical point about sexual abuse at festivals, which is a huge, huge issue, and there have been recent campaigns and studies to try and improve this and give women a greater security and safety at these things. But you're kind of looking at it, and it was almost a pornographic take on sexual assault, which is obviously the wrong, completely wrong way to do it. So that kind of felt really queasy watching them condemn this stuff while also zooming in on the acts that they were condemning. We don't need to see those things. You could just say, people, there was sexual assault. We don't need to see the video footage of that.
I also don't know whether... and we won't know that until we speak to those people, whether there is some sort of broad support, because this might start something in trying to investigate those historic situations. I thought it was a fascinating watch, right? Yeah. We all agree that it's compelling viewing. I just thought it was a documentary on toxic masculinity in very many ways.
I felt
from the older guys who just wanted to make money and didn't give a shit about anything else, to the corporate sponsors, to the entitled thugs that want to burn stuff just to feel something, to the opportunistic groper, to everything about it was that culture of toxic masculinity. Yeah. And I thought it was also a really interesting parable on consent. I found it deeply, profoundly scary because it reminds you of just how much of our daily lives, on how many levels, depends on the vast majority of people doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Well, and how if the people doing the wrong thing tips from 1% to 3%, you're fucked.
Well, there was one talking head who kind of summed up that kind of contradiction, that duality. It was one guy, and to be fair to him, he looked like Beavis and Butthead at the same time. And he talked
about... I know exactly who you mean,
I quite like
those
guys. Yeah.
But there was one little bit where he kind of went, oh, yeah, we went into the pit for... Limp Bizkit or Cold or whatever, and said, it got so hairy, we thought, oh, we're not going to come out of this alive or whatever. And then right at the end, they say, oh, so what think of Mike? What do you think of it? He said, I still think it's the greatest weekend of my life. And you're just going, you just didn't get it. You were there, you saw all of this awfulness taking place, but maybe that is your life, that was the absolute highlight of your life.
Or maybe if you're half a mile away from the stage and you're not really in the middle of the riots and you didn't get that wreck.
But he said he was right up the front and he thought he was going to die. He did. Yeah.
There's no account.
I mean,
taste.
One of the women that was groped said, I'd do it again. And it was an incredible experience.
Insane, yeah.
Just weird.
Well, for me, it is a summation of why 1999 to 2001 is the absolute worst period for music, youth culture, television, and everything in the entire history of the human race.
It's not a good advert. It's not a good advert for
It's not a good
culture.
Advert for anything.
Yeah.
just got time for some more tunes. We don't often get a chance for the panel to make a choice, but hey, it's summer. Alexandreo, what have you chosen to recommend to the listeners?
Oh my goodness, I am so excited to be choosing tunes, which I never ordinarily do. So this is a Norwegian band called Bruen, spelled B-R-O-E-N, and the track is called Shut Down. And I need to declare an interest here. So my niece is the vocalist for the band. They're signed up to Bella Union. They're playing festivals at the moment, so they're about to kind of hit the big time. They are a very unusual outfit. They are very Scandinavian, very collaborative. They make weird costumes for each other for each gig. There is a tuba player, a synth person, and a bass player, and a drummer. All of them also play really weird little instruments, jingling here and there, and table harmonicas, and they do loads of sampling and stuff like that. I think it's varied and interesting music. They do things not just with the harmonies that are innovative, but they do things with the beat that are different. And I absolutely love that. They use meters which are unusual, which switch from like 4 beat to 5 beat and back again, which are counterpoint to the melody. And I just love them so much, and not just because I'm the singer's uncle. I went to see them at the Barbican a couple of years back, and the show just blew my mind.
Well, have a listen. This is Bruen and Shut Down. Which brings us to the traditional choice of the greatest record of all time. Not that we can ever play them, they're very hard to clear, but we can add them to the playlist. Eamon Ford, what's your choice?
Wow, I've already given one in the past, but this is my other favourite record of all time. I picked Substitute by Clout, who were a South African all-girl rock band who were fantastic. And it was a cover of a Righteous Brothers song from a couple of years earlier. And famously, and topically, it was capped off number one in the UK by You're the One That I Want by John Travolta and the late Olivia Newton-John. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful song. And it's basically, it's kind of a heartbreaking as a premise, which is basically saying a girl singing to a boy going, I know that you're not happy in your relationship, but if you ever kind of want to trade them in for me, I'll kind of be the second best if you want me to. But it's just a wonderful, wonderful song, and I love everything about it. And their logo was incredible because the O of Clout was like a pair of pants.
There you go.
Dig it out.
Straight on the playlist. Alexandreo, what have you got?
Yes, I get finally the opportunity to push a bit of opera.
The greatest song of all time
people.
Is. Yes.
So the greatest album of all time, in my view, is the very first recorded recital of Maria Callas, the great opera singer. It was recorded in 1949, so it's on the cusp of phonograph records to LP. It was issued actually on both. It's a recording by the Italian record company Cetra, which actually had top-of-the-line recording facilities at the time, rivaled really only by EMI, which is the company Callas went to 3 years later. It captures her at her freshest, and there is something magical and mystical about it because it involves both the heaviest, heaviest arias. So she sings from Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, she sings Isolde's death song. effectively, which is considered the heaviest thing for the most dramatic soprano voice. And then on the other thing, she sings things like Bellini's Puritania and Norma, which are considered the lightest material for the lightest soprano coloratura voice. And this was a feat. Mm-hmm. You know, this is someone walking across a tightrope between the two towers or over the Niagara Falls. That's what this album is. And it is an extraordinary achievement and one that still sounds as fresh today as it did how many years ago? 70? 73
well,
years
well, the
ago.
Good news is you can judge for yourself because this is out of copyright, so we can play a bit.
Hurrah!
So here's a bit of Casta Diva with Maria Callas recorded on November the 9th, 1949. Deep crate-digging opera beats here. Get your ears around this.
Hurrah for the public domain.
And with that, we're at the end of the podcast and it's closing time chatter. What will we be discussing as we drink $12 water standing next to a burning bin waiting for Kid Rock to come on? Eamon, what's your closing time chatter?
My closing time chatter is I'm not big on the gram, but I'm on there.
As in the Instagram, I
Instagram,
hope.
Yes. I'm posting terrible pictures of nothing, but I got a recommendation and I kind of went, and generally your recommendations are terrible, but it's this kid whose name is Oscar Whiteney and his Instagram handle is Brian Jones Fashion Icon Fan. Very long name. And he's this kid, he looks about to be about 13 or 14 and he's got the proper Brian Jones pudding bowl haircut and he tracks down vintage clothes. So he dresses like Brian Jones kind of between 1965 and 1969. And his commitment to this is incredible. And also, he just seems a really charming kid. So it's kind of nice to see a young kid on Instagram not being an awful influencer, just this kid going, I'm obsessed with
Brian Jones
and kind of 60s culture and mod culture, and I'm going to get all of these clothes. And whether, because he's small as well, he's probably getting a lot of these things custom made as well. And his attention to detail is amazing. It's just a wonderful thing to have this kid who's so obsessed with this world and joyously showing it off to people. And it's just a really lovely Instagram account to follow. So,
what's it called? Brian Jones?
His handle, his name is Oscar Whiteney, but it's all one word, Brian Jones Fashion Icon Fan, all one word. Yeah.
Quality.
It's brilliant.
It's lovely. I'll show you the pictures in a minute. Cool. He's wonderful.
Very nice. Alex, how about you?
Well, let me drop the tone. So all the Mission Impossible films are on all four at the moment.
Excellent.
I just showed them all. And we've rewatched them in order ahead of the big two-part conclusion to the franchise next year. They hold up exceptionally well, I have to say. The action is as good as any Bond film. There's loads of humour there, including about Tom Cruise being short, like all the time, which is quite unusual.
Wow.
He, you know, he's sensitive about it, famously. I have an admiration for him, you know, yeah. Because he really knows how to pick a script. He's one of those people that you look over a career of quite a lot of films, you know, over 50 films. And I was seeing like a list of his worst. Okay, let's exclude The Mummy, that recent abortion. But a list of his worst 10 films includes Legend, by Ridley Scott, and Days of Thunder and Vanilla Sky. And I just think if I were an actor who had made 50 big Hollywood films, and among my 10 worst were Legend, Vanilla Sky, and Days of Thunder, I'd be pretty fucking pleased.
I wouldn't.
So hurrah for Tom, I think.
Yeah, well, and
Sean, if you're listening, still would.
I would not consider myself remotely a Tom Cruise fan, but I have watched by accident or intentionally a lot of his films, and he's done a lot of good films. Yeah. It's weird because I would never ever say, oh, I must go and see the new Tom Cruise film. But the ones that I've seen have been great.
Same with me. But, he's not weird. Like Nicolas Cage. Look at just this desert loads of dead turkeys. Yes. What's yours, Andrew, this week?
Mine? I am enraged at the stupidity of the BBC getting rid of the classified football results at the end of Saturday.
Andrew? How often did you listen to them?
All the time, actually. It's just
a
soothing thing.
Why? Don't you have a phone?
It's not the point. It's the ritual. It's the And also, it is the recognition that the pyramid of football exists and League Two is as important as the Premier League. And, Scottish Premier League matters and you need to know that it's East 54455. You need to hear this. If the BBC decided to get rid of the shipping forecast to save 4 minutes of airtime in the dead of morning, there would be marches with burning torches and pitchforks on Broadcasting House. This thing is part of the heritage of football, and it's going to do what? Add another 4 minutes of Chris Sutton talking rubbish.
Yeah,
I'm enraged by it. I think it's pointless.
What if they put it out at the right time as a mini podcast for you? Would
not
that
the point.
Satisfy
not the point, because you're loads of people in the car driving home. People are about to make the dinner. It's part of the day. And the real thing that annoys me about it is if the BBC had tried to find a section of people who were broadly in favour of the BBC and tried to work out a way to make them angry at the BBC, they couldn't have done it better. The only thing they could have possibly done to make it better was to, have an asteroid hit Ambridge or something.
I'm no football fan, as you know, but I think the point you make there about the fact that they go down into the lower divisions is really important, because it's about those teams that don't have this huge amount, these millions of dollars sloshing around. It's the teams that are kind of living hand to mouth and have local support, and that's important to nurture that.
And it's part of the idea that no football exists except the Premier League. Yeah. And I'm a Liverpool fan, but I want to know that Hamilton Academicals exist. I want to know what's happening with Preston North End. Yeah. I want to know.
I mean, I'm a big football fan. I haven't listened to it in years. I tend to look at the results sort of on the computer or the phone. And to me, it was always connected to a culture of playing pools, which is, my father was a gambler and was a hideous memory of my childhood because you would lose a lot of money.
You have a reason to dislike it.
Really upset. No, I'm just saying that it's not just linked to all this lovely stuff. Yeah. It's also linked to gambling.
Yeah.
Well, that's all sport.
Should get rid of all of it then. Okay.
I'm for that.
Let's not do that. I'm hoping that it's one of those sort of fake announcements that's designed to have a very public reversal so that everybody can give the BBC a round of applause. I have a feeling, sadly, that it isn't.
And that's the end of the podcast. Thank you, Eamon Ford, for joining us on the Culture Bunker.
Thank you for
having
me.
You were our only guest, but a very special one.
Yes, you were our best guest today.
You filled that chair magnificently. Sean and Yelena will be with you next week with a very special guest, Brett McKenzie of Flight of the Conchords, will be present to talk about his new album, Songs Without Jokes, and much more. So hit that subscribe button now.
Remember, you can get all the tunes on our rolling playlist. The link is in the show notes. From me, from Alex, from producers Alex Rees, Yelena Sofronievich and Jade Bailey, thank you for listening. Back next week. Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
The Premier League. Aston Villa 3, Everton 2, Arsenal 2, Leicester City 0, Brighton Hove Albion 2, Newcastle United 2. Wait a minute. This is the wrong script. The Culture Bunker was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison and Alex Andreu. The producers were Yelena Sofronievich, Jade Bailey, and me, Alex Rees, with assistant production by Kasia Tomashevich. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.
It's a busy world out there. Once you've woken up and got on top of all your WhatsApps, your texts, your emails and your DMs, then you've got another pile of stuff to get through. The news. Honestly, who's got the time? That's where Papercuts, the brand new podcast, comes in. Paper Cuts is your fast, funny tour of all the best bits of the papers, from the biggest scoops to the weirdest headlines to the definitely not made up showbiz gossip. And it's out every weekday with me, Miranda Sawyer, and a host of guests, including tip-top comedian Marcus Brigstock. Marcus, what's your favourite thing about Paper Cuts?
It's the puns. It's obviously the puns. I mean, when we go through the papers and you see what creative beauties the people who work, particularly in the tabloids, have come up with. Often I think it's pun first, then story for them. Like, I've got one. Find a story to match this. But it's a really fun part of the podcast to see what they've come up with every day.
Especially the Daily Star.
Oh, the Star, proud to love animals.
So if you want to be on top of the news and have a laugh while you're doing it, get Paper Cuts every day on your favourite podcast app. We're out around lunchtime, Monday to Friday. Perfect for a bit of me time in the middle of a busy day. That's Paper Cuts. We read the papers, so you don't have to.